Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Wat Chit Awan in the series of the Noble Eightfold Path Talks. Tonight is the next factor, the seventh factor, right mindfulness or samasati. Now, we're going to use the same formula every night. Yeah? 1 hour talk, 30 minutes plus for... plus, you know, like...
Maybe,
you know.
I'll try 45 minutes to give... more time for Q&A.
Sure. Okay, so 45 minutes for Q&A. So for questions, we will take questions written down. There's a question box just right at the door. Someone please lift it up. Okay, there's a question box at the door. Write down your questions legibly and we will pass the box down to Ajahn at the end of 1 hour. So we have our retreatants here. This is also a meditation retreat during the day. The retreatants, the yogis here, has been doing practicing right speech, noble silence, right action, meditating with right effort. And tonight is the talk on right mindfulness by Ajahn Brahm. Let's put our palms together and invite him to give this talk.
Okay, I'll give a talk. Oh, there's a car which is badly parked. And if that car isn't moved soon, it will get reborn as a bicycle.
And the car number is WNV6098. WNV, oops, okay.
Oh, that's embarrassing. Never mind.
Thank you.
We'll keep your place warm for you. So this evening's talk is about right mindfulness, where we're aware of where we can park our car and where we shouldn't park our car. So it is like awareness, and of course, that is a very famous factor of the Eightfold Path. It really is overdone. There's other factors which are just as important, if not more important than right mindfulness. And also, people don't have too much of an idea of what right mindfulness is. Some people think it means to be aware of the state, aware of everything that's arisen in our minds. We can't do that. That is impossible. There's so much stuff which arises in our minds and in our body and in life. We have to be selective. Life is like a buffet, and we choose that part of us which is going to be good for our health. And that is where mindfulness will always be selective. And this is the most one of the most important parts. What are you going to be mindful of? And the trouble with most human beings, they're just mindful of thinking. They think so much that they never actually are alive. They just live in thinking. So, that's why we have these practices of mindfulness to bring you back to the real world. Sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're a monk, you don't live in the real world. Ha ha ha. I do, you don't. I never use makeup. When I look at my face in the mirror, it's actually as it is. All you girls, you don't know what you look like, really. There's so much thick makeup. There's Botox, there's uplifts, there's downlifts. I don't know what you do. But you're really fake. As for a monk, this is what I look like, with no adornments. And so this is actually the real world where we start to become aware and alive. And that is why, for many people, it's great, first of all, being not aware of all of your thoughts which drive you crazy, but being aware of more of your physical feelings, being aware of the body and its feelings, because then you feel much more alive. That's why on this retreat, I've asked many of you to go walking outside without any shoes on. So you're not feeling the protection of your shoes, but you're feeling the earth, or you're feeling the concrete, or you're feeling the snakes. No, don't feel the snakes under your feet. So you're actually alive and you're feeling sort of the tactile sensations of your feet on the floor. Take off all of those blankets and feel the cold. My goodness, it's warm here. I'm boiling and some of you are still wearing coats and blankets. I don't know how you would survive if you left Malaysia and went to another country. So that's why sometimes it's nice to feel cold. It's nice to feel heat. It's nice to be able to feel the water on your body as you're out there in the rain getting drenched. Because then you become aware of your physical feelings. To go out and listen to the sounds of nature. Not just the sounds of your head, but the sounds of the birds and the cars and the water and the wind. Because when you start to be aware of these natural phenomena, you do become more alive, more awake. And it takes you out from that fake world of thinking and stuff into the real world of experience. So that's one of the first things we do. And one of the points I'm really, really surprised at is just how out of touch with their body people are. So much so that you get aches and pains in the extremities of the body. And sometimes people don't even aware of them until it's too late. Sometimes you may have an ache in the body, and when it's too late, you have to amputate something. It reminds me of the story of one of my relations who went, a friend in England some years ago, and he was in a motorbike accident, the poor thing, and they had to amputate a leg. That was a terrible, but even worse, it does happen, you know, sometimes, that when they put them in surgery, there was a mistake and they amputated the wrong leg. Have you heard that actually happens? So as soon as they realized the mistake, they had to take him straight into surgery and amputate the leg which couldn't be used. So he lost both of them. And of course, as soon as he was able, he hired a lawyer and sued the hospital. But he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. Okay, that's a joke, okay. It's all right to laugh. It's not a true story. I make these things up. So, so sometimes that people are so unaware of their bodies, they get sick in their bodies and they don't know what to do about it. But as you learn a little bit of mindfulness, number one, it increases your health because you're far more sensitive to what's happening in this body in which you live. And developing that sensitivity can do miracles for your body. I've mentioned to some people in this retreat that as you do a mindfulness of the body, we usually call it a mindfulness of the body scan, going right from the bottom of your body up the body and feeling all the different sensations in places in your body you've never felt before. And that's why in the mindfulness sweeping or mindfulness scan, which I teach, we start at our toes. Because so many people are so unaware of their toes and their feet. In fact, when as a Western monk I first went to Thailand, most of the time we didn't wear shoes or sandals. We had to walk barefooted, especially on arms round. And we were always stubbing our toes and stepping on things, so much so that our feet of all the Western monks, including mine, were always having band-aids on. And when Ajahn Chah saw the state of our feet, cuts and bruises, he said, "You Westerners have stupid feet." And he had a point. Our feet were stupid. We were very smart in here. We could argue all sorts of things. But our feet were stupid because we weren't mindful of where we were treading. When you're wearing shoes, you can tread anywhere, especially where you're wearing boots. You can tread anywhere and you don't get hurt. And because you're protected, you lose your mindfulness. So that's why it's good to start being aware of parts of the body you've never been aware of before. And I told this, I think in the interviews, it could have been in the morning, about one of my monks who had a very bad spine. He wanted to meditate, but it was always painful, so he went to see the doctor, and the doctor told him, or gave him a CT scan, and found out that he had a congenital defect of his spine. And there was nothing the doctor could do except to advise him, don't meditate. And that's like telling a cook not to eat. It's like, you know, telling a bicycle or a painter not to paint. This is what he loved doing. He had to do this. So he was in a difficult situation. There was nothing he could do. He loved meditating, but it was always painful. So he learned this practice of mindfulness of the body, which solved the problem. He read in a book that there are muscles on the side of your spine which most people are totally unaware of. We don't have any mindfulness of them. So what he had to do was, with his hand, stroke those muscles so that he could start to feel those muscles. In neurology, this is just creating those neural connections in the brain, creating new connections, because every time he touched his those muscles on either side of the spine, he made a new neural connection, reinforced it. I would say the neurons who fire together, wire together, yeah. Neurons which fire together, wire together. So he actually connected those neurons until, with many weeks of just stroking those muscles, he could feel those muscles without even touching them. He could experience them in the same way that you can experience your shoulders, you know what's happening in your hands. He could experience what was happening in those muscles. He developed mindfulness of them. And the next stage was to learn how, now he had contact with those muscles, he could feel them, to learn how to stretch them and relax them, stretch them and relax them. He learned how to do that once he could be aware of them. And once he could stretch and relax them, he could exercise them. And he had an exercise regime every day for those muscles, and now they have become so strong they compensate for the weakness of his spine, and he can sit without any pain. Now that is the sort of thing which mindfulness of the body can do. It can contact you with parts of the body you've never experienced before. You, by first touching them, and then you can feel them without touching, your neural connections have been made, and then you can start to do things like exercise these things. That is one of the reasons why we develop mindfulness of the body, because there's heaps of things we can do. There are so many miserable people in Kuala Lumpur that I teach people, when they come to me and they're depressed, they're sad, they're having a hard time, I give them the 20 push-ups exercise. You know the 20 push-ups, don't you? If you want to, if you're really miserable, depressed, having a bad time, please do 20 push-ups every morning. When you go to the bathroom, stand in front of the mirror with your feet apart, get your two fingers up and...
1, 2, 3, 4...
And exercise your smiling muscles. And after you've done the 20 push-ups with your fingers, then you'll be mindful enough to do it without the fingers. And then you'll be able to have such strong muscles on either side of the mouth, you will be happy. And also attractive, all you young men and young women still looking for a partner. I know why you haven't got a partner. You look miserable. No one would ever like going out with you. So smile more, because every boy and girl tell me they want to go out with someone who's fun. So you've got to sell your fun part. Forget about big breasts or nice hair or sort of being a tough guy. Being a smarty, smarty guy. And that makes you irresistible to the opposite gender. Give it a try. So this is actually being mindful even of your facial muscles. So you can relax and smile. But that mindfulness of the body goes even further. You can be mindful to all parts of the body. And I mentioned this to someone earlier. It's the mindfulness of the body practice which actually heals emotional distress. And especially one of the terrible problems people have in our modern world of anxiety. So much is demanded of you. You face so many tests in your life, social, work tests, life tests, that people often get so afraid and anxious and they fail those tests, whether it's at school, in life, go for an interview for a job. It could be an interview for a dog. I remember a story of a dog going to an interview, actually, this is another aside, because there was, in Australia, a job for a secretary. But it was, in Australia they have very strong laws against discrimination. So you can't discriminate according to gender, you can't discriminate according to race, nor can you discriminate according to age. Just because a person's old, it doesn't matter. If they can do the job, you have to give them the job. So there was a job advertised, non-discriminatory job, for a secretary. So a dog walked in for the job. And the person thought, we can't have a dog, but we can't discriminate. So they decided to give him a test. Okay, get on the computer and type a letter. So this dog was amazing. He got on the computer, he opened it up, he opened up Word Office, and with these paws, he typed out a letter as dictated. Amazing dog. And I thought, hey, this dog is smarter than we thought. So, do a spreadsheet. So he got on the computer again and did this excellent spreadsheet. He thought, my goodness, look, there's one way we can get this dog. He said, in this job you have to be bilingual. So they asked the dog to speak another language. And so the dog went, meow, meow. Okay. Now anyway, where was I going back to? Interview for a job, you're anxious. So when you're anxious for a job, you get all this stress. And the technique which I've developed, which I teach far and wide, especially to psychologists, was developed when there was this one young lady who had extreme anxiety disorder. Depressed, anxious, even paranoid. She was so anxious she couldn't even leave her bed in university. And the psychologists and doctors at Adelaide University could not help her. So, when no one else helps, Ajahn Brahm comes to the rescue. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And she was lucky because it was her mother was a Buddhist. And so she knew about me, so she called me and said, can you talk to my daughter? She's in a big mess. She hasn't left her bed for weeks, and no one can help her. She's got extreme anxiety. So I called her, and she told me what was happening. And I said, when you're anxious, when you have these panic attacks, where do you feel it on your body? And she said, I don't know. So I said, give me a call in 3 days when you can tell me. I gave her something to do. This was the first exercise in mindfulness of her body, so she could feel anxiety in her body. And after a few days, she gave me a call. She said, I feel it just in my chest area. It's in my chest. And so my second test for her was, can you describe that feeling for me? She said, I can't. It's just anxious. That's all. I said, that's not good enough. Give me a call in 3 or 4 days when you can give me an accurate description of that feeling. So I was increasing her mindfulness. And she was a brilliant lady because in 3 or 4 days, She gave me a call and gave me this very accurate description of the feeling which came whenever she got anxious in her chest. She had developed mindfulness of that part of her body enough that she could explain to somebody else exactly what she was feeling. Not just it's hot, it's cold, it's hurting. I want more than that. You've got to be more aware so you can give a good description to a stranger. And once you got to that stage, the next stage was very simple. I said, whenever you get an anxiety attack, a panic attack, and you feel that sensation in your chest area, get your hand and massage it with compassion. Give it as much loving kindness as you possibly can do. If you can't do that, I told her, because she had a boyfriend who was cooking and cleaning for her because she was totally incapacitated, said, get your boyfriend to massage your chest for you. That's what boyfriends are there for. And then give me a call in 3 or 4 days. In 3 or 4 days, she gave me a call and said she'd followed the instructions. When she had that panic disorder in that chest area, she got herself or boyfriend to massage that area as much as he possibly could. And I said, what happened? He said, oh, the tightness in my chest disappeared. And then I asked her, and what happened to the emotion of anxiety? And that was when she paused. We call these light bulb moments. She said, when the physical feeling vanished, so did the panic. It went too. And I told her, wonderful. Now you know how to deal with your panic disorder. Don't try and attack it in the mind because you're not skilled enough to deal with an emotion in the mind. You usually get negative towards it and make it worse. But people are much more sensitive to the body. So once you're aware of where that panic, that anxiety manifests in your body, massage it, give it loving kindness, you'll be able to deal with the physical counterpart to anxiety so it disappears. And you'll always find when the physical part disappears, so will the mental part. She said, thank you. A couple of weeks later, she was out of bed, back to university. She graduated with first class honors in dentistry. 1 year later, she married that boyfriend, and I did the ceremony for her. A very happy ending, and she was so impressed with the therapy which I gave, which the classical psychologists and doctors couldn't help her with, she nominated me for Australian of the Year. I didn't get it, but I did appreciate the gesture. And she still keeps in touch, even though she's now in Sydney, a brilliant girl with a very happy marriage, who through mindfulness of the body had learned also to deal with emotions. And if any of you ever have anxiety at an interview for a job, making a presentation in public, please, this is how you can solve the problem. There will be some physical feeling in your body, not necessarily in your chest, that's where it manifested for her. Be mindful of it, be aware of it, and once you're mindful of it, you can give it compassion, and you will find when the physical counterpart goes, so does the emotion. The two are connected, the body and the mind. And that's a brilliant way for dealing with anxiety. And so if you see anyone, Usain Bolt, about to race the next 100 meters in the Olympic Games, if you see him rubbing his chest before he takes off, you know where he got that from. Another disciple of Ajahn Brahm. So when you have a bit of mindfulness of the body, it's amazing just how you can relax parts of the body with a bit of compassion, and incredible healing happens. Many people have had these operations where they have these huge scars on their body, and by giving that awareness to that part of the body and giving it compassion and kindness, it's amazing just how quickly that heals. Of course, the record was this lady, she's Singaporean, living in Perth. She had a mastectomy one afternoon. The next day she came and offered dana in our monastery. I couldn't believe that. I said, what, did the hospital let you out? Yeah, it said, no, it's healed enough. And I gave it incredible mindfulness and compassion. It's amazing just how quickly these things can heal.
I couldn't believe it myself, but she had a whole breast removed in the afternoon next day at Bodhinyana Monastery. Woohoo! That's really good. So it's amazing what you can do to your own body with some awareness and some kindness. So that's where we start, with being aware of our body rather than in our head. And it's amazing what we can do for our health and happiness, even emotional happiness. We can actually be a little bit more in control by being aware of our body and also aware of our health, because you can feel parts of the body which are getting tense and you can relax them. Whether that tension is around your heart area, you can just relax it just through will, because you're aware of that part of the body, and awareness gives you the opportunity for what I call feedback. You're aware of, say, the area around your heart, you can feel it get tense, you can feel it get relaxed, and after a while you can relax it as an act of will. Because you feel it's relaxed, you feel it's tense, you know what causes the relaxation, what causes the feeling, the mindfulness gives you that feedback. So it's amazing how you can control parts of the body. It's pretty much how people do if they're dancers, professional athletes, especially gymnasts. They get so aware of their body, they're aware of parts of their body which you and I are not aware of at all. Which is one of the reasons I don't dance in public. But this is what they become aware of, and because of that training, it's amazing the sorts of things you can do. So awareness of the body is a brilliant exercise, because it gives you more things you can do for the health and happiness of the body. But that's only the start of awareness. That is why in the classical Buddhist traditions, we say the four focuses or foundations of mindfulness, the first is usually on the body, because that's one of the easiest things to be aware of. So we can know our body in which we live, become more sensitive to it, we can have more success in life, and also much greater health. But when you have these four foundations of mindfulness, we also have to be aware of our physical feelings, of happiness and pain. And I'm really surprised how many people are very aware of only half of that feeling world. Pain, suffering, misery. So in these retreats, I try and make people more aware of the other side of life, the happy side, the beautiful side. I remember doing a retreat in UK many, many years ago. This must have been about 25 years ago, in a town called Doncaster. Doncaster is in the north of England. It was an old coal mining town. And when I went there, those were the days of Margaret Thatcher, where she closed all the coal mining towns, and the people were out of work, it was depressed, it was dirty, the local government couldn't pay any money to keep things looking nice. It was the most dirty, depressed town you could possibly imagine. And when I went there for the weekend retreat, people said, "This is amazing. Most people go out of Doncaster on the weekend. You come here. That's really weird." But when I went for a walk in the morning, I found a nice park to walk in. And when I came back and the organizers of the retreat asked, "Where did you go to?" And I said, "I went for this beautiful park." He said, "That's amazing. That's the only beautiful park we have. And it's wonderful that you actually found it. Because the monk who came a month ago, he went down to the gasworks for a walk." And I said, "That's typical of that monk. He's always so negative. If you have the choice, he'd go to the industrial estate. Me, I'd always go to the park to see the flowers." Because if you incline towards happiness in life, you will always find it. You're aware of happiness, its causes. You can feel the happiness in your body and the pain in the body. You can feel the happiness in the sight and happiness in sound. Why is it that people always look for problems? Me, there's enough problems in life. I'm not going to look for problems. I'm going to look for the bright side of life. And it's only a matter of choice if you do that. And I say you can come into this monastery, this temple here, and see all the things which are wrong in it. As for me, I see all the things
which are right in it, which creates happiness with a feeling of pleasure and pain, happiness and misery. It's amazing how much choice you have. In life, you can see all the things wrong with your wife. And if you do that, you can have a very terrible day. Or you can see all the wonderful things in your wife. It reminds me of that story someone told me about their marriage. They were married in Singapore, and after their marriage, her father took aside her new husband, his new son-in-law. And he gave the son-in-law some advice about marriage. He said, "Son-in-law, now you're married to my daughter. You probably think she's so beautiful and charming. You probably can't see any faults in her." And he said, "Yes, she's so wonderful. She's so beautiful. She's so charming. Even the way she picks her nose is so cute." And he said, "Yes, that's what it's like when you fall in love. Everything she does is wonderful and charming and beautiful. You can't see her faults, but those faults are there." He said, "I know my daughter. And in 2 or 3 years' time, you will start to notice her faults and defects. But son-in-law, I want you to always remember this. When you start to notice her defects and faults, please remember, if she never had those faults and defects to begin with, she would have married someone much better than you." Which is very true. Be happy the guy you've got, because you've got faults and defects. And he's got faults and defects. If he didn't have those faults and defects, he'd have married someone much better than you. I always like thinking like that. So it means you're grateful. So instead of seeing the faults and defects, you start to see for the beautiful side of a person. Now this is something which I learned to do, and it had an amazing effect. Especially when I went into prisons. You'd think that there you'd see all the defects in the people in jail, the scum of society, the worst of the worst. But when I went into prison, as I've talked to you before, I've never ever seen a criminal, never seen a murderer, never seen a thief or a rapist. I've only ever seen a person who's murdered. I've seen a person who's raped, but never a rapist. There is no such thing as a liar. There's a person who's lied. Knowing that difference, you can see there's an other side to even the worst people in this world. And you do have a choice to see the crime they have done, which is terrible, or to see all the other things they have done in their life, which are very beautiful things. Which one are you going to see? I made a conscious choice when I went into prisons to see the other part of the person, not their crime, for which they were serving time, to see the other part of them. And an amazing thing happened. When I saw their beautiful part, I could respect them. They were surprised that someone was treating them as a human being, not as a murderer. And they started to see that part of them themselves. When they started to be aware of the positive side of their life, that side started to grow. And that is why the people who went to my class never reoffended. They came out, started their life again, and became very successful. That was very effective. And I do that when I see anybody. Yes, you may have made a mistake, but you are not the mistake. When I was teaching some time ago to the north of here in one of the universities, I think, forget which it, where it was, after my talk, someone asked the question, "I've just caught my husband lying to me this morning. I can't trust him any longer. Should I get divorced?" It's amazing the questions you get in question time. "My husband lied to me this morning. I caught him out. Should I get divorced? I can't trust him." So I first of all, I asked what she was doing in that university. She was a lecturer in mathematics. I asked her, how long you've been married? She said, about 3 years. So I said, now I can answer your question by doing some statistics. Because I was doing maths at university as part of science. So 3 years, that's about 1,000 days. And let's assume for this argument, every day of your married life, your husband has said, on average, 20 things to you every day, which could be right, which could be wrong. So since you've been married, he's made 20,000 statements, which could be right, which could be wrong. That's a fair assumption. And now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, it means the next time he opens his mouth and says something to you, there's a 20,000 to 1 chance on past experience that he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? 20,000 to 1 is a pretty good odds. I could trust that. If you could find a politician who told the truth 20,000 times instead, you would trust them, wouldn't you? What do you mean you can't trust him? And she got the point. One lie is all we see. 20,000 truths we don't see. One murder is what you see. 100,000 kind acts we don't see. Why is it one pain in a body we see, the rest of the body which is happy we don't see? Oh, my toe hurts. What about the rest of your foot? Oh, yeah, that's okay. That's why I keep telling people, you've got a bad leg, it doesn't matter, you've got another leg, a spare. You know, hop. You see that, you know, the kangaroos in Australia, they hop, they're okay. It reminds me, I'm sure I've told this one last time, but I can't. You know the difference? We have many, many Buddhist kangaroos in our monastery in Perth. You know Buddhist kangaroos? You all know the difference between a Buddhist kangaroo and a Christian kangaroo? There is a difference. I'll show you. A Christian kangaroo.
They put their paws like this.
A Buddhist kangaroo puts their paws like this. So we've got Buddhist kangaroos now. But anyways, seeing the happy side, we become aware of the happy part of life. Now, of course, psychologists teach that all the time, so that you can get more energy and power. When we remember the past, it's much better to remember the positive side of the past. So in a company, for example, when something goes wrong, they have all these meetings to try and find out why it went wrong, and to try and find out who is responsible for it going wrong, and to take action. When you keep thinking about the mistakes of life, what happens? You get angry, negative, and you lose motivation. As I've been teaching many businesses, forget about what went wrong. How about remembering the happy part of life? What went right in your company? When something goes right, have a big meeting. Find out what went right and why it went right, and reward the people responsible. That way, you will repeat the causes of success. You will learn what causes success, you repeat it. And that's much more effective business policy than keep thinking about the past, which was wrong. Think about the past, which went right. And that's the same with relationships, husbands and wives. At the end of the year, we come into the end of the year soon. Instead of looking at the last 12 months and thinking about what went wrong, and about all the terrible moments you've had together, and trying to figure out how to fix those terrible events, that really makes you upset, depressed, angry. How about looking at what went right in your relationship? The happy days you've had, the times you were in such harmony and had a great day, remember that, figure out why, and then you learn the causes of a happy marriage. If you keep thinking about what went wrong, you'll get divorced. If you keep remembering what went right, you'll learn the secrets, and you won't be able to repeat those causes. That's why that when we do even mindfulness of the feelings, we should be mindful not just of what went wrong, because we do live in a very negative society, always critical,
always seeing the bad side of life. Instead, we should look at the other side, the happy side of life. And that's even the case when people are sick in hospital. You know, please, when you go and visit someone who's sick, please never tell them, "How are you feeling today?" That is the most stupid question in the whole world. If they were feeling fine, they wouldn't be in hospital, would they, stupid? If you see someone in hospital, that's what the doctors and nurses keep asking them. Talk about something else. Don't talk to the sickness. Talk to the person. They're not a sick person. They're a person with sickness. The person is much greater than that. And I can imagine if I was sick in hospital, here we come again. They say, "Oh, how are you feeling? How's your cancer going? Look, that's really depressing. I want to hear about something else." And that's actually why it works when you start talking about something else in life, seeing the happy side. That story that there was a nun I was counseling in Perth. She had terminal cancer. When her cancer got so bad, she had to go into a hospice. I used to visit her. She called me one day saying, "I think I'm going to die soon." She was perfectly correct. 2 days later, she was dead. If any of you hear from your loved ones and family, they think they're going to die. They know much better than the doctors. So if they say a day or two I'm going, they are going. Take it seriously. I knew that, so I took it seriously. I stopped whatever I was doing. Went to that hospice. But these are very sick people on the edge of death. You can't just barge into their room. I had to check in with the duty nurse first of all. And that was one of these duty nurses from hell. Because when I checked in, she said, "Who are you?" I said, "I've just come to see this nun." "No, you can't." I said, "Why not?" "She has given explicit instructions. She wants no visitors. Go home." "So she can't do that. She just called me an hour ago." "I don't care. Go back." "But I've come all the way, an hour and a quarter." "Look, we have to respect our patient's wishes." She was so fierce. She was Australia's answer to Margaret Thatcher. And I could be quite stubborn too. I said, "Look, this can't be right." So she glared at me, said, "Come with me." So I followed her. And when we got to the patient's room, there was a big sign on the outside. "Absolutely no visitors." And she pointed to the sign and looked at me. "See?" And I love telling the story because I looked, and right on the very bottom in small letters were the words, "Except for Ajahn Brahm." And I couldn't resist looking at that nurse and saying, "See?" As a monk, you shouldn't do that, but I just couldn't resist. She deserved it. But when I went into the room, I had to ask the patient, said, "Why did you put that notice on there?" And she said, "Because you're the only one who comes into the room and doesn't see my sickness. And sees me instead." And I got it. As I hope you get it. She just said, "What's the latest joke? Come on." Because, you know, that's what I like doing, telling jokes. And so we had a nice time together. Yeah, we talked a little bit of Dhamma. But it was mostly just giving her an uplift. She was fed up to here with people seeing her sickness, which made her really sick. So look at the other part, which is what happens when you can do mindfulness of feeling. You can see the other part, not just the pain, the happiness part. And if anything you need to do to get balance is to see a happier side of life. So that becomes like a mindfulness of these things as well. You become much more aware of even your emotional world and actually how you work and what makes you happy and what makes you positive, what creates success in life. You're getting to the idea of like being aware of these things. And with awareness, then you can get some power in your life. And especially health in the body and health in the mind comes from such awareness. And we make that such a positive thing in Buddhism that now that you can do so many classes in places like Oxford And in Toronto, I was there teaching a class on meditation and mindfulness and medicine and psychology. It's such a popular unit now because this mindfulness really works. When people become more aware of their body and their feelings and their emotional world, they really can get much more healthy and successful in life. And many of the problems, such as depression, one of these terrible things which happens to human beings. And the British National Health Service did some research because they only had a limited budget. They had to find out how they can spend their money to get the best results. And so their research arm did research into three therapies for depression. One was the medication. Number two was counseling, otherwise known as cognitive behavioral therapy, but it just means sitting in front of somebody and just talking over the problems. And lastly was meditation, the mindfulness training. And they compared those results in a huge study, and they found out the medication was just placebo effect. It didn't really work. That really pissed off the medical companies. The pharmaceuticals, rather. Number two, they found cognitive behavioral therapy, speaking to somebody and getting counseling, that does work. But nothing worked as powerfully as mindfulness. Awareness, becoming aware. Because what you were doing, you were becoming aware of what happens in your mind, and especially the thinking. And how so much thinking gets negative. Just like the negative feelings in the body, we pay more attention to pain than happiness. We also pay more attention to negative thoughts than to positive thoughts. You can actually see that when you actually listen to how you think. If you don't believe me, listen to how people speak, which is a reflection of their thinking. So many people are negative. They always say the government is terrible, the economy is bad. Every time I come to Malaysia, I usually ask, how's the economy going? When it's booming, no one says it's booming. They're always saying it's going okay. They do that. When it's really terrible, you know, they really say, oh, it's really... But when it's, you know, sort of little bit bad, they say, oh, it's terrible. We always exaggerate on the negative side of life. And we always think the very worst. One of the ways to overcome anger and ill will is to give other people the benefit of the doubt, which is positive thinking. By which I mean, if someone has cheated you, don't think they're a cheat. Give them the benefit of the doubt. They must have made a mistake in their accounts. If someone has lied to you, don't think they lied to you. Maybe give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I misheard what they said. Whatever it is, you will find if you give people the benefit of the doubt, you give them the most linear interpretation of what they've done, you will be happier. And they also will not cheat you so much. A lot of times, you get misunderstood. How many times have people accused you of things you never did? Many times, haven't they? And you've accused other people of things they haven't done. You misunderstand each other. So that's why giving people the benefit of the doubt, that positive thought in your mind, oh, my wife must be in a bad mood today. Maybe she started menopause today. Give her the benefit of the doubt, and then you don't get so angry. So that is like using your thought positively. Because your thought is such a powerful tool, it can create so much pain to you, but also so much happiness. And we're never really aware of it to train it. In the same way, when you start to become aware of what's going on in your ears, and especially whether it's a positive thought or a negative thought, you're aware and you check. How am I thinking? You will find the negative thoughts, if you keep going on with them, will create so much depression, anger, and will even make you sick. But if you can develop that positive thinking by being aware, and if it's a positive thought, oh, what a wonderful day it is today. That's why when it is raining, I always say, this is auspicious. It's raining. This is holy water from the heavens. You don't have to ask the monk for it. It's all provided, as much as you like.
And when it's sunny, it's even more auspicious. You can go out and wash your clothes and dry them. Whatever's happening, it's auspicious. If there is an earthquake, you can just put your washing in the tub and it shakes itself. So you can save electricity. Whatever happens, you can always see a positive side to it. So that type of positive thinking, you will find, will make you successful and happy no matter what happens. So this is why one of those, the third of those satipatthanas, is actually being aware of how you think and how you react to things. And we become so, we always react in a bad way, and we can just change our mind so easily and react in a good way, and we can actually be happy, healthy people. So mindfulness, which is on the thinking mind, it means also you can stop thoughts which are leading in the wrong direction. I don't like that thought. Throw it away. It's not that hard to do when you're aware. In the same way, when you're aware of the feelings in the body, you can calm down the negative feelings. Even the thoughts in the mind, you can learn how to stop those too. With mindfulness, and you can see what is necessary to stop them. So that mindfulness goes into the mind as well, and it learns how to become more aware of life, more aware of the happy parts of life, being able to let go of the negative parts of life, which is why the mindfulness is a very powerful part of Buddhism. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why Buddhism becomes popular in our world, because people who practice such mindfulness actually do become happier people, healthier people, which is why that monks like me have to work my butt off. I could get negative about that, but because I have mindfulness of my thoughts, I never allow those negative thoughts to keep coming on, because they torture me. You know, sometimes I think, why do I have to give another talk tonight? You've heard all this before. Why don't I get the little doll made of me for Madame Tussauds? And then I can put an old talk in. I'm sure I've given a talk on right mindfulness before. Put the CD in, or connect it to the computer, press the button, and all the doll needs to do. And then I can have a nice time in my cave doing nothing. So, sometimes that happens. Sometimes I did get negative, but I decided that's not the correct way to go, because if I wasn't mindful of those negative thoughts, they would have taken off a long time ago and caused me a lot of problems. Like the one time when I was living in Thailand, I found a nice monastery to meditate in. But even in the meditation monasteries, they have ceremonies, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, these big festivals. And this was one of those festivals, actually Waisak Day. And you know that everybody comes to the temple on Waisak Day. And I just wanted to have a quiet time meditating. And hundreds of people I'd never seen before came to the temple. And I was the only Western monk. So I was a star attraction. And they wouldn't leave me alone. They came up to me, especially because I could speak Thai. And I don't mind talking to people about meditation or Buddhism. But did they want to know about meditation? No. They just came up to me and say, "What country are you from?" And they asked, you know, "Have you got any brothers and sisters? And what did you do before you became a monk?" They never asked me about, you know, meditation or Four Noble Truths or anything like that. They just wanted to know what country I come from, whether I got any brothers and sisters, and what job did I do before I became a monk, and why did I become a monk. And after about 20-30 people ask you the same question, you really get fed up. So I decided to escape. My trick was I needed to go to toilet. Even monks have to go to toilet. And I didn't really need to go, but I pretended. So I went to my hut where the toilet was and escaped round the back. And when they didn't know what I was doing, there were caves in that monastery. And I went into the deepest of caves. You had to go up a bamboo ladder through many passages. And you went to the bottom of the cave, which was about 100 meters from the entrance, really deep, and it was very quiet in there, but had good air. I've been there many times before. I thought, great, now I can meditate and get rid of all those people with their silly questions. And you know what happened. I was only sitting there no more than 5 minutes when I heard this sound of people coming down the passageway in the cave. They hadn't seen me come in. What had happened? They too had got bored with the sermon of the senior monk. They've had enough of that stuff. And they decided to explore the caves. And my luck was so terrible, they decided to explore the cave that I was in. And I could see they had like an oil lamp. I could see the light get stronger and stronger. And then one of them came round the corner of the passageway at the end of which I was sitting. And they saw me. And they immediately went back. And I could understand their tired, their conversation. The man who had seen me said to his friends, "There's a ghost in the end of the cave." They thought I was a ghost. And I thought, may it be so. Because if they thought I was a ghost, they would not come down that cave at all. They'd leave me alone. And I thought, please. And then two people's heads came down around the corner. They had a look at me and they came back. "No, it's not a ghost. It's a Western monk." "No, it's not. It's a ghost." "No, it's a Western monk." It was touch and go for about 3 minutes. And then I lost. "It's a Western monk." And so about 20 people came down that cave. And they sat in front of me, and one after the other, they asked me, "What country do you come from?" "What? How many brothers and sisters have you got? What did you do before you came?" Now you realize in life you can't get away from that. So then I use the mindfulness of thoughts. I say, okay, look. I've got no choice. They're going to ask those questions anyway. So I can enjoy it or I can get negative. I had that choice and I chose to enjoy it. So instead of getting negative, I had fun and started talking about, you know, how many brothers and sisters I had and what country I came from and stuff like that. Sometimes having fun. When they ask where you came from, I remember my teacher, Ajahn Chah, he said the same thing. "I come from my mother's tummy." Which is very true. Sometimes you had a joke, you know, "Why did you become a monk?" I say, "Because of broken heart." The women love that. "Ah, poor thing." It wasn't true, but I was just having fun. But when you have to do things you don't like, you've got that choice to be mindful of your thoughts and give it a positive spin. You've got to go to the dentist. I have to go to the dentist too. Do you like going to the dentist? I keep positive spin when I go to the dentist. Those dentist chairs are the softest chairs I ever get to lay in. You're not allowed to have high and luxurious chairs except when you're sick. So I have this wonderful chair. You know those chairs, the back goes up, it just contours to your body. I love those chairs. And number two, the dentist put all sorts of stuff in my mouth. At last, no one can ask me any questions of where I come from or how many brothers and sisters I've got. I could actually be quiet and meditate while they're doing their stuff. So that's why I always see the positive thing about going even to a dentist. So when you have that mindfulness of your thoughts, you can actually do something to get rid of all the negativity which causes you so much pain. I've got to go to the dentist anyway. Why not create a positive thought? And it's not that hard to do. Which means you're not so miserable in life. You've got to go to work. Even I have to go to work. This is holiday time. And I've been working many hours every day. And I don't even get paid for this. I could get very miserable and say, "Why me? Why doesn't some other man?" Well, this is a very wise monk over here. How does he get away with it? He's much wiser than I am. But no, you create that happy mind. So when you develop mindfulness, it gives you more opportunities in life. Sometimes what mindfulness actually is, my definition of mindfulness, is instead of just having one door to go through in the journey of your life, mindfulness means there's three or four doors you can go to. You're much more aware of the possibilities of life. It literally does give you more choice when you're more aware. There's many other things I can say about mindfulness, especially the strengthening of the mindfulness through meditation, where it really gets powerful. You literally can see more and see more deeply, and especially the different ways you can deal with the problems in life. You don't always have to be a creature of habit, always with the same negative responses to things. No one can wind you up. As they say, people can push your buttons. When you're mindful, you know where those buttons are before anyone else does, and you can disconnect them. Which is why people, they try and upset me, calling me, "You are so fat, you're like a pig." And I just say, "Oink." I got my choice to do that. So my mindfulness says, I'm never going to allow anybody to control my happiness. Just what you say or what you do, I'm not going to allow you to make me unhappy. My awareness of the way I respond can give me that choice. Whatever you say or do, it's my choice how I respond. And I decide not to respond by getting upset. If you try and make me unhappy, I will refuse. If you don't give me any food tomorrow morning, I think, great, today I can fast. So, I like fasting over in the West. When I fast over in the West, I eat fast food. Very delicious. So you kids, tell your mummy I'm fasting today. I'm going to McDonald's. Fast food. Okay, so enough fun and games. I've gone over again. I was supposed to finish at 9:15. So nevertheless. So thank you for listening for some aspects of right mindfulness. Sadhu. 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 Okay. So let's get some questions here from the magic box. Very good. Here we go. Lots and lots of questions. It's going to go on to 11 o'clock tonight. Doesn't matter. I won't answer all of them. If your karma isn't good enough, your question won't get answered. It's not my fault. A question about how to face death. In case we are terminally ill or have an accident, knowing we're going to die soon, what are the things we can do right before death? The first thing to do is sign all your assets over to the BTF. No. Help with citing a mantra, listen to chant, to calm us down, many thanks. If you prepared yourself beforehand when you're about to die, the best is to say, let go, let go, let go. You can't carry anything with you, but the problem is people try. And they get attached to all sorts of things instead of just saying, no, the end of the life, now's the time to let go. And to give it a positive spin, be mindful when you're dying, be happy. You say, great, I've escaped the old people's home. That's a wonderful thing when you die young. When you die young, especially women, you escape menopause. Yes, I got no menopause. I've got away without it. Oh man, you've escaped Alzheimer's, arthritis, and all these other diseases of old age. Yes! So, you can always look at the positive side of anything in life. So when you're dying, keep positive. You lived a good life. Now is the time to go. There's that story I say about the two old people, man and wife. They'd been married for many years. So when one died, the other one died afterwards, within days of each other. That happens really often. They live life together for such a long time. When one goes, the other one soon goes afterwards. And because of their good karma, they got reborn in a heaven realm. And an angel came to meet them. And the angel said, because of your good karma, because of all the generosity and kindness, keeping your precepts and meditating, I've come to show you your heavenly reward, which was this beautiful mansion overlooking the cliffs. Million-dollar views, bigger than the Sultan's Istana. A huge mansion. And as soon as the guy saw that, he said, "Wow, someone on my salary could not afford the government taxes." Because you have government taxes in Malaysia? Bigger the house, the more you have to pay? He says, "It's too big, I can't afford it." And the angel said, "Up in heaven, there's no governments. No politicians make it up here." So, but there's no governments anyway. So, he took him inside. It's all for free, okay? He took him inside. And inside this Istana, there was such amazing furniture. Plasma screen TVs, 100 foot wide. There was chandeliers, and on those plasma screen TVs, the angel said, "I know you like EPL soccer. I know you support Liverpool, and they're not doing so well this year, but up in heaven, they always win at the last minute, because it's heaven. You'll always have a good time up here." There were chandeliers with amazing crystals, and even in the bathroom, I always like talking about the bathroom, even the toilet bowl was made of solid gold. Solid gold. And when you press the button to flush the toilet, water never came out. I hear you've got the same problem here yesterday. But up in heaven, it's not water comes out. Out comes Chanel number 5. Just to brush the wash the toilet away. It's heaven. And he took them down. Took them down to the... first of all, the guy said... "This is such expensive furnishings. Look, a golden toilet. Now the thieves will come up here. I don't think I can afford the insurance premiums." And the angel said, "Sir, you don't have to pay insurance up here. This is heaven. There's no thieves up here. You don't have to pay anything. It's all for free." And he took them down to the garage. The garage was the best. Triple garage. With 3 cars. The first car was a 4-wheel drive, go anywhere vehicle. And he's so powerful, said the angel. It can not only go up and down mountains. That's easy. This is a new superpower 4-wheel drive. It's so powerful, it can even go up waterfalls. That's a powerful car. And the next car was a stretch limousine. Have you seen it? I was actually in Las Vegas in this huge stretch limousine. And this was a massive stretch limousine. So big it had a swimming pool in the back. And the third car was the best of all. A Ferrari. A red Ferrari special edition. And the angel said, "I knew, sir, that you loved your sports cars." But he said, "What's the point of having a fast car in KL? Too many traffic jams," he said. "And even if you do go on the toll roads, there's too many policemen with speed cameras. So what's the point of a fast car?" And the angel said, "Sir, up in heaven, no traffic jam. Up in heaven, no speed cameras. You can go as fast as you like," said the angel. "And if you have an accident, it doesn't matter. Because you're dead already." And then they opened up the garage doors. And on the opposite side of the road was an 18-hole golf course and a resort clubhouse. And the angel said, "We knew how much you loved your golf. So we built a golf course right next to your mansion. So you can enjoy yourself with your heavenly reward." And he said, "On this golf course," because it's a heavenly golf course, "whenever you get your ball on the green, whichever way you putt it, it will always fall into the hole." If you've ever played golf, it really sucks when you just putt the ball. It just reaches the rim of the hole and goes out afterwards. Now, whichever way you putt, it always goes in the hole. And the angel said, "Look at that clubhouse. That's only for the really elite. You know, those are only for the datuks and datins of this place. I would never be able to get elected into such a resort." And the angel said, you're already elected. You're not a life member. You're a death member. Play as much as you like. And at that, the angel left. The angel left him to his wonderful golf course, Ferrari sports car, and beautiful mansion with the 100-foot plasma screen TVs on which Liverpool always won. And as soon as he left, the man got angry at his wife. Really scolded her. Got so upset and angry. He was scolding her for 10 or 15 minutes, and when he paused for breath, his wife said, why? Why are you so angry at me? You got your golf course and your sports car. I know how much you loved. You dreamt of having a fast sports car. Now you've got one. And I know how much time you spent watching Liverpool on the TV, and they always lost. You got upset. And now they're going to win every time. You should be so happy. Why are you so angry? And that's when he looked at her and said, because. Ugh. Because, wife, if you hadn't given me all that healthy food, I could have been up here many years ago. That's why you should never eat healthy food. Fast food. Okay. So, think of that when you're dying. When you're in a car crash, you're about to die, terminal disease. Yes! Ferrari sports car's coming next week. Golf course, woohoo, can't wait. Why is it that people, they want to go to heaven, but they're scared of death? That's the only way to get to heaven. You've got to die first. So if you've done lots of good karma, you know you're going to heaven. As George Bush used to say, bring it on. Okay, that's one question done. Oh my God. I do apologize. Sorry. Okay. I'm a biology teacher. I need to teach students to dissect animals, rats and frogs, to study their digestive system, etc. Am I breaking the first precept? Should I change my job or subject I teach? Please advise. Thank you. As long as the frog is dead before you dissect it, I hope it is. Can't you get plastic frogs these days? Really, can't get one made in China? They're very good in China. Make plastic frogs so you can dissect it. And do you have to dissect real ones? Oh, that's I had to do that once. I was teaching physics in a school, and we had this lesson. We had to dissect a bull's eye. You know, like to actually to see just the way it had a lens in there and how the light actually made an image on the back of the eye. So I had to go to the butcher shop and ask for half a dozen eyeballs. And they asked me, what do you want that for, you pervert, or something? And I said, it's for school. School, okay. And said, oh, school, okay. And so they gave me these about half a dozen. Now, they're huge. Now, the cow's eyes are huge, and this is the male cow's. The bull's really big eyeballs. And this was my, I was a trainee teacher, so I gave them out, shared them out. And know what the boys did? I tried to collect them at the end of the lesson, but one went missing. And I was told by the other teachers what the boys were doing. They were going up to the girls. With my eyeballs. I got into trouble for that. Next time I had to make sure I got them back again. But no, sometimes, if it's a dead frog or something, you don't kill it yourself, that's not so bad. But as a biology teacher, if you have to kill it yourself, you may refuse and say, no, I'm a Buddhist, let someone else do that, and I will just do the dissection afterwards. So sometimes we have to do that in a biology class. If you can get away with it, please do. Next question. When I sleep, I lay down and find my body disappearing. I sleep in light and soft, gentle breathing as I started. As I started washing dishes, I feel only the upper side of my body. Hang on. When I sleep, I lay down and find my body disappearing. Yes, that's what's supposed to happen. Otherwise, you can't sleep. I sleep in light and soft, gentle breathing. Great. As I'm standing washing dishes, I feel only the upper side of my body. Can't feel my legs much. As I'm standing talking to people, there is a rising and passing of thought, then silence of mind, and I can't feel my leg and my body. I feel no body there. So, Ajahn, am I practicing all right? How to live mundane life like this? if you're playing soccer for Liverpool, you must be able to feel your legs. But it really depends what you do in your life. Usually you find on a retreat strange things happen, but when you actually go back into the world, all that peacefulness and those weird experiences tend to disappear. So don't worry about that. You'll all come back to normal again. But while you're on retreat, you can do some amazing things so your body is not so much of a problem. It looks after yourself while you're being more mindful of the thoughts. That is par for the course, not a problem at all. If we can enter jhanas or enlightenment that easy, we don't need to be a monk or a nun to do that, do we? It's easier if you're a monk or a nun. But once you do enter jhanas, I should have told you this before you enter jhanas. Once you do enter jhanas and become enlightened, people want to become monks or nuns. Why go to work? Now why have a husband or wife? Too much suffering. Remember the three rings of marriage? What's the first ring of marriage? Engagement ring. The second ring of marriage? Wedding ring. The third ring of marriage? Suffering, yeah. I know a man, and he told me that when he was going out with his girlfriend, before they got married, they would always hold hands. After 20 years of marriage, he still holds her hand. Isn't that sweet? When they were going out, he held her hand out of love. After 20 years of marriage, he holds her hand out of self-defense. Why are you laughing? I tell you why, because truth. So that's why people become monks or nuns. Why not? It's good fun being a monk or a nun. Someone asked Ajahn Chah why he became a monk. And he said, in Thailand, in the villages, that sometimes they used to play monks. You know, like you play house when you were a kid? They used to play monks. And he'd always volunteer, even as a kid, to be the monk. Because they get some brown cloth, which he put around himself. And he said he'd just sit there, and all his friends would bring him nice things to eat. Ever since that time, he always wanted to become a monk. He actually said that. He's a very funny man. Dear Ajahn, is loving kindness and non-violence a natural byproduct of the jhana experience? Yes. How do Zen monks incorporate loving kindness in their practice? I don't know how they do that. Continue. Does traditional Zen masters who engage strong will approach reach the same depths of jhana experience? Now, I've met a lot of those Japanese masters and Korean masters. On the outside, they appear tough as nails. But when you guys go and they're with other monks, they relax and just mess around and tell jokes like everybody else. Because sometimes, we have our cultures, and it's okay in Malaysia, I can tell jokes and get away with it. But when I went to Hong Kong in a Mahayana monastery, people were quite surprised that a monk was smiling, laughing and telling jokes. But they loved it there. So one of the nuns, when I left the first time from Hong Kong, she came up to me and said, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for coming, Ajahn Brahm. After people saw you, now I can smile as well. And I thought, what a wonderful thing that was. Because everybody's, all cultures are the same. So the monks and the nuns will tell jokes to each other. But sometimes they think, oh, when we're in public, we better be serious. But really, they're all just good fun. So even the Zen monks tell great jokes as well. Here we go. I would like to use your books, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, and the Art of Disappearing as my meditation guide. How should I use them? How you should use them is sit on them to get a good posture and practice what they're saying. So don't keep studying them. Read them and follow them. That's what it's there for. Otherwise, like I'd say Zen people have a great sense of humor. One of the first monks I saw was a Zen monk. He came to London where I used to go to this Thai temple to give a talk. I'd go and see any monk or nun who gave talks because they were few and far between in those days. And this monk gave a talk to a translator. After going touring around England for about 1 month, he came back to give another talk. By this time he had learnt a few words of English And so someone asked him the question, what do you think of Buddhism in England? This was in 1969 or 70 or something. What do you think of Buddhism in England? And this Japanese Zen monk answered in fluent but simple English, Buddhism in England. Books, books, books. Too many, too many, too many. Dustbin, dustbin, dustbin. And that was so fluent. And it was true because many people, they were just reading the books, now following the containers and not really paying attention to the contents. So the book there is as a signpost. Please practice. Can I use the online community at dhammaloka.org to talk with a member of the Serpentine Sangha guide in my meditation? Yeah, you can. So we do have a little blog there. You can actually ask your questions. I never answer them. One of the other lackeys does that for me. So I'm very lazy. That's why you delegate. That's the best thing in life, to delegate things. So I delegate all that to my students. But if they get it right and people praise them, I take the praise. But if they get it wrong, I blame them. That's what delegation is. You always take the praise and take the sort of thing, but you delegate the blame to Lai Ping. No, poor girl. She's doing a good job. In a few Buddhist historical sites in India, it is said that the Buddha has performed a number of miracles, like taming the drunken elephant, making multiple representations of himself in the sky, descent from the heaven, a monkey serving honey to the Buddha. Are all these real stories or just legends? How are all these miracles possible? Now, there was one of the monks in Thailand, one of the other disciples of Ajahn Chah. Someone gave him a monkey because sometimes these monkeys, they were mistreated, so they put them in this forest. And because the monk was very, very good with the monkey, he could get the monkey to do anything for him. So this particular monkey, if the monk needed a banana, he'd just point to a tree, and that monkey would climb the tree, get a banana, and then he would offer it to the monk and then put his paws up like this. Now that was a very well-trained monkey. And of course, sometimes people have their dogs, and they train their dogs to bow to the monks. Now, one of the ladies who came this afternoon had a dog and would always be able to bow to the monks. So you can do that. Remember that cat in Brickfields? He ran into the Brickfields temple one day. No one knew where this cat came from. Went into the main shrine. Stood on two legs with its paws looking up at the Buddha. I remember Dr. K.C. Dhammananda. You know, he had a photograph. I had a photograph of that. I've lost it. And he said, no, I don't want to tell too many people about this. But from that time on, that cat had a free lunch and a nice place to stay. And it's an amazing photo. Now, this is not digitally enhanced. That cat was on two legs, paws up, looking at the Buddha in a shrine. Just ran in and did that straight away. So the animals can do these things. They're not just miracles. Some of these things are actually true. So sometimes we don't usually make too much of a thing about miracles, because then where people keep on coming up to you. As I remember when I first went to Australia with another monk, this young boy came up to the monk I was staying with and said, how much? What do you mean, how much? He said, how many inches? What do you mean, how many inches? How many inches can you levitate? Come on, show me. And all they wanted to do was see a monk levitate. Now, if I did that, levitated in front of you on camera, then all the scientists in KL would be doing experiments on me. If I read your mind and prove I could read your mind, the CIA would get me to interrogate all of the detainees in Guantanamo Bay to find out what they're really thinking. I would have no peace and kind. If I could actually scan your minds with X-ray visions, they would put me on the airports to scan people because it's much better than scanning with the Aussie electric cameras. I'd never leave me alone. I'd be a circus freak. So if you could even levitate, Australia would put me in the Olympic Games as high jumping. So that's why we don't show psychic powers, because you get into trouble if you do psychic powers. So they do exist, though. Who is Amitabha Buddha? That is Amitabha Buddha. He's got a picture of him on there. See his picture? A smiley face? That must be Amitabha Buddha.
Amitabha Buddha.
Amitabha means unlimited radiance. What actually is a real Amitabha Buddha? Not a being. Where can you experience unlimited radiance? Nimittas. That's where you experience an Amitabha. Unlimited radiance. In a few Buddhist historical sites in India, I've got the miracle one, do it again. I think it's enough attention to give to snorers. Yeah, poor things. It is really about the snoring or the controller. Eh? We are crossing paths and all on board on Buddha Air with great crew, good service and good captain. We are stuck with each other, ha ha. It reminds me of another story. Because this one guy, he went on one of these airlines. And he was sitting next, he was in the middle seat, and on the aisle seat was a parrot. A parrot. It must have been an Air Asia flight, because they say now anyone can fly. He was sitting next to a parrot. So he didn't mind that. Again, a parrot's a small, he could stretch out a bit. But after they took off, the flight attendant came to take some drink orders. And a parrot looked at the flight attendant and said, "Give me a whiskey, you cow." That's really rude. And she was a bit taken aback, and he said, "And can I have a cup of coffee, please, ma'am?" He was very polite. And the flight attendant went to the galley, and she was so shaken by being called a cow, she forgot the coffee and just came for one whiskey for the parrot. And the guy said, "Please, I wanted a coffee, please, madam." And then, in that time, the parrot downed the downed the whiskey and said, "And get me another one, you bitch." That was so rude. And that upset the flight attendant so much, she went to the galley and came back with a second whiskey for the parrot and forgot the coffee. So the guy thought, "I'd better try the parrot method of getting any service." So he looked at the flight attendant and said, "Get me that coffee, you pig." And the flight attendant went to the galley, and she came back with two big male flight attendants who took the both of them out of their seats, opened the emergency door and threw them out. And as they were plummeting down to the ground, the parrot turned to the guy and said, "You really have bad mouth for someone who can't fly." Okay. Okay, very good. So I just make the most of it. And the more negativity we give to the annoying snores, the more it is going to be. So Ajahn taught us how to do it, is how we make peace with ourselves and everybody else around in nature. Everyone snores, non-regular snorers snores, when one is super tired. So I take it to be like Andrea Bocelli singing Italian an opera. Wow, people can really snore beautifully. That's why we are here, to acknowledge, forgive, learn to make peace with things that we can't control. Coughing is as bad as well, but we accepted it, maybe because Ajahn said so, it's okay. We conditioned our mind, wishing all beings happy snoring. So that's just saying that sometimes if you can't stop it, you just got to accept it and just let it be. Very good. Anyway, it's only one more day, and then you can go home and pray with your husband who snores. Can meditation be practiced while we are talking, listening, reading, and something, etc.? Or can only be done during sitting and walking? The meditation which leads to jhanas can only be done when you're sitting. When you're walking, if you get into jhanas when you're walking, so you don't feel your body, you don't know where you're walking, and you might fall into that pond over there, or off the balcony, I don't know where you might end up. So please, if you do fall into jhanas when you are walking, please wear crash helmet. Okay. I'm not going to get anywhere near finishing today. Oops.
Dear Ajahn, thank you. What energies carry you through your sustained state of worshipping the Buddha? Gratitude, Buddha is a high being which I emulate, or reverence, inspiration. What sort of energizes me is usually inspiration. Because I like getting inspired when people tell me they're getting some happiness from the teachings, it's solving problems, they're getting deep meditation. So that's why I do this, because, you know, just if one of you says he gets some really good meditation, or some of you get some help, then that inspires me to help you even more. Dear Ajahn Emptiness, if in one of meditation sitting I feel like a very huge white colour place which has no end. Do I fall into one of the jhana 5, jhana 8, the one which is played of something like infinite space? No, they have to go through the ordinary jhanas before you go to these immaterial jhanas. If yes, should I avoid that because Buddha only encouraged jhana only up to level 4? My understanding may be wrong. Kind of give some advice. All the jhanas are worthwhile, but to get into the second jhana, you have to go through the first. To get into the third, you have to go to the second. So if you go to those ones, you have to go through the ordinary jhanas. And if you'd go through the ordinary jhanas, you'd be coming up to me crying and just, oh, so nice. Dear Ajahn Brahm, just now you mentioned when a person went into deep meditation, his heart would stop. Won't the heart cells as well as other cells in the body die due to the lack of blood carrying oxygen to them? And how can the brain cells survive after that without having any oxygen at all? But they do. And I remember this doctor who came up to me. And he was a Buddhist, and he said that when he went to medical school, the professor in charge of the medical school, a very skilled scientist, he welcomed all the new students. I think this is in Royal Prince Alfred in Sydney. He welcomed all the students with the words, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 8 years or 6 years is wrong. Our problem is we don't know which 50% it is. Now that's a good scientist. Science is always work in progress. It never reaches a conclusion, because what things like medicine said were true 20 years ago has been proved to be false. So we're always making new discoveries, and especially when it gets to things like the heart, the brain, the blood, especially with meditation. This is a new area which science hasn't explored yet. And it raises new questions, but it is true. The heart does stop, and the heart is fine. The brain stops, and there's no damage at all. In 1 minute, okay, I've got the white light one. If you don't believe me, try it. When I sit in a meditation pose, not vipassana meditation, my body begins to sway and bend forward and backwards. At times I feel my buttocks tries to leave the floor. Great! You could be the next high jump champion of Malaysia. Let it leave the floor. That's what it feels like, but it's not leaving the floor. This is just what I mentioned about what happens in meditation. Your perception gets deconditioned and it starts to imagine things which are not really happening, but it feels true, it's not dangerous at all, just let it happen. The perception is just becoming free. I feel relaxed and restful after coming out of the meditation of about 20 minutes. That is good, that is normal. So just enjoy it. What is meant by the Western Paradise or Amitabha? Where is it? I've been to the West. You go to England, that's the West, or even go further, go to the United States. And I'll tell you, it's not a paradise. So this is something which came after the time of the Buddha. What happens during the first lunar month, the ghost season? People say that it's dangerous to go out at night during that month. Is it true? Perhaps it might be. It's time for another ghost story. We're not going to answer the questions tonight. Did I tell the story? The guy went to the temple and it was the coffin story. No, okay, this is a really spooky story. This guy went to the temple one night.
on his way home, it was only about, you know, a kilometre, half a kilometre back to his home. This was in Australia. But the way home was past the cemetery. And even Australians are scared of cemeteries, especially at night time. I don't know why this is. It may be the same in Malaysia, but it's certainly the case in Australia. The street lights, you know, to lighting the lights, they're always further apart when they go past the park or a cemetery. Where the houses are, they're much closer. So it's always darker and spookier. But, you know, it was only a short distance. So, you know, he was walking past the cemetery. He got halfway. Everything was fine. It was only just after he got halfway, he thought he heard something following him. Now, you may have had the experience before. Most of the time, it's imagination. But nevertheless, your senses get very aware if you think someone's following you. It could be a thief, it could be a stalker, or it could be something worse. So he involuntarily started walking a little bit faster. And whatever it was following him, also came faster. And he listened very carefully. So he walked even faster, and so did the thing following him. He wanted to look around to see what it was, but he was too scared. As you are, you know, you don't want to see it. But by the time he got to the end of the cemetery, whatever it was catching up with him. So he decided to look around. And as soon as he looked around, he wished he hadn't. Because following him, was the sort of thing you wouldn't even like to see in your nightmares. Following right behind him was a coffin. Vertical coffin. Going bump, bump, bump after him. With the dirt and the cobwebs coming off as it was chasing him. He started running as fast as he could. Doesn't matter how fast he ran. Bump, 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 bump. The coffin was still catching up with him. He got to his gate, the front gate of the little garden in front of his house. He didn't even open the gate. He jumped over it and ran to the along the path to his house. The coffin came to the gate, bump, and broke the gate down. He got out of his keys to open his door. You know what happens? He dropped the keys. Oh no! Bump, 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 bump. Came the coffin after him. He picked up the first key, put it in the lock. That was the right key. He opened the lock, got inside the door, slammed the door to. Bump! Just as the coffin reached the front door. And he could see it through the glass panel. But he'd made it inside the house. He was safe. Bump! As a coffin started to hit the front door. Bump! As the hinges started to give way. Bump! Only a few moments and that coffin would break down the front door of his house. He ran up the stairs to the only other room with a lock, which was the bathroom. As he got to the top of the stairs, bump! As the door gave way, and there was nothing between him and the coffin, he looked at the coffin down the bottom of the stairs, and the coffin saw him at the top of the stairs. Bump, bump, bump. Up the stairs came the spooky coffin. He dove into the bathroom and locked the door. Bump, bump, bump. He could hear the coffin coming up the stairs. Bump! As it hit the bathroom door. Bump! Even louder. The wood began to splinter. If that coffin could break down the front door, there was no real hope for him. He went against the wall, waiting for his fate, with his arms spread out. Bump! as a coffin broke through. There was only a couple of feet between him and sheer terror or death or something worse. No more place to go. Just as an act of desperation, he took something on the shelf and threw it on the coffin. The bottle broke and this brown liquid went all over the coffin. And the coffin stopped. Because what he threw on that coffin was cough medicine. It stops the coffin. As it says on the bottle, cough medicine stops all the coffee. Okay. I'm crying so much for my own joke I can't read the... Okay. That's the rest of it. That's a ghost. Okay. The ghosts aren't that dangerous. Okay. Okay, what's the next one? This is just a comment on the topic of the sex act is painful. I said this afternoon. Really stirs people. I always get some comments in this. The facial expression of people engaging in sex and being tortured are quite the same. That says a lot, doesn't it? Like drug addicts, some engage in sadism and masochism to get that high. Getting high has been by being tortured or torturing others. Real perverts? You're all perverts except monks. No. But it's interesting, that was something which I brought up today. A very powerful message. Now, is it pleasure, is it pain? Since there's no one there, why should I still need to meditate? Exactly. There's no one there, so who needs to go home to work? Become a monk. Become a nobody like me. In Australia, do you have any special room for the snorers? It would encourage more natural snorer to come for meditation in future. One of my friends is a snorer too. She is so worried to go for a holiday with others. I don't dare to invite her for meditation too. Sada, sada, sada. That would be very good. Have like a snorer's retreat. No, that's why in Australia, in my meditation retreat center, everybody has their own room. So you don't hear the snorers. They can happily snore in their own room, and you can get into jhana in your room. Happiness at last. Perhaps as a snorer you can get a job. Get a job in Guantanamo Bay. After a couple of days living with you, the terrorists will confess anything. Okay, if I am right to assume that all animals that reproduce by sexual activity are of pure mind, they instinctively fight for sexual rights with the object to reproduce the next generation, this is right effort. I don't know where this is going. If human beings have sexual activity for that purpose and pleasure is only coincidental, would it be still against the precept? Not a serious question, just for laughs. Well, if you think like that, then you must be an animal. Because that's what it said at the beginning. Animals fight and that's natural, so if you want to be like animal. But dear Ajahn, what is Buddhist stance on social justice and politics? We read Burma's monks did something to protest the government. Some Tibetan and Vietnamese monks set themselves on fire as peaceful demonstrations, but I doubt these really work. Any suggestions to non-violent strike and something Buddhists can do to bring about social changes when the government is corrupted and some evil regime, e.g., I won't say what's on here, I get into trouble, when some regimes are in power. What should you do for evil regimes if you are a Buddhist? Now, one of the things is you do have your democratic rights. You put those regimes in, and a lot of times people vote for corrupt regimes Because they promise you things. They promise to give you what you want, less taxes, more benefits, and you know they can never do that. That's why the way that we elect our governments is fundamentally wrong. We elect people on what they promise to do for us. So whoever gives the best promise gets our votes. And that encourages people to make promises they can never keep, which is why politicians in all countries break their promises. So instead of doing that, I like the system which was used in ancient Rome, where people were elected on what they've done in the past, not for what they promise in the future. Because at least you can find out who is honest and who is competent. As someone pointed out, how would you elect a CEO of a company? Would you get a number of candidates and who promised the best? Or would you check out who had the best track record? And it's the best track record. So politicians should be elected on past performance, and they should not be even allowed to promise things for the future. Because all promises are of a future whose we don't know what's going to happen next. The economy, the social situation, even the geopolitical situation changes so fast that governments who make promises and try to keep them will not be able to adapt to the circumstances as they change. So as a monk, I see that politicians should not be asked to promise for the future. You should elect them on the competency which has been shown in their past behavior. And then we won't get so much corruption. But as for social action is concerned, this is what a monk can do. We can give some nice advice, see things from a different way, so that people can be encouraged to choose governments in a good way. But as for monks doing social action, the Burmese monks were not protesting against the government. I know many of those Burmese monks. The reason they were protesting in Mandalay, because the soldiers were taking all the food. There was no food left in the market for anyone to eat. It was a hunger strike because people were poor. So it was nothing against the government. It was just against, please, you know, we need food. But then it got taken over by other political motives. It had become an anti-government protest. But it started off just as simple, the people are hungry. I read Lobsang Rampa, the Tibetan monk's third eye, and many others. Please tell us precisely what the third eye is. I've got four eyes. So a third eye must be when somebody has a monocle. No, people think the third eye is what happens in here. There are such things as psychic powers, but sometimes people call it a third eye, but it doesn't exist in an eye. This is just psychic powers which sometimes happen through deep meditation. So that's a bit of fluff and nonsense. What is astral travel, and does it happen in the jhana stage? Not in the jhana stage, but sometimes pre-jhanas people leave their body. But it's a waste of time because, you know, it's much easier instead of leaving the body through astral travel, just walk there. It's much more comfortable. Except there was one guy, he could astral travel, and you know, he learned that when he was a kid in Yugoslavia. There was an operation happened. He was outside of his body, a near-death experience. And he, even though he was a young boy, he knew the doctors were looking in the wrong place. He just willed them to look in another part of his body. They saw the problem. He got healed. And from that moment on, he could astral travel. But just because he was astral traveling didn't mean that he was a good guy, because I saw him in prison. He was put in jail for something he did. But he never minded being in jail. It was okay being in jail. Whenever he wanted to leave, they couldn't stop him. So he told me he used to go to nightclubs. He used to go and watch movies. You know, with his astral body. So they checked up on him. His real body was still in the cell. But his astral body was really somewhere else. So he didn't mind being in jail. So it does have benefits if ever you have to go to jail. That's a true story. Burning of joss sticks symbolizes virtue, but the resources of the world are dwindling, and burning contributes to global warming. So under present conditions, would it be more virtuous to promote the stopping of the burning of all incense? I reckon that's fine. So sometimes in these temples, we have electronic incense. You just press the button and they light up at the top. Is that a good idea? But people are so angry at the burning of incense, that's why they call themselves getting incensed. So that's a terrible pun, isn't it? Anyway, I'd better stop before I go any further. So you don't have to burn incense. It's much better to be a good person. I get loads of vivid and colourful dreams with strong emotions that come up during the retreat. Write them down and send the script to Steven Spielberg. In daily life, I seldom have that many dreams. Is it a relief of emotion or a cleansing of karma of some sort? It's usually just a letting go of some of the emotions, old baggage which comes out in dreams. So if it happens, just let it come. A friend of mine who has meditated for some time and since then developed the power for seeing things. Not all are accurate, but the bad things which he foresees very often come true. Paranoid of this, he stopped meditation. Then what should he do, actually, can Ajahn advise? Yes, sometimes that people apparently do see the future, but a lot of it is uncertain. So you really don't know unless it actually happens. So you can't trust those things. So if it's causing a person a trouble, it's very easy to stop. I should have actually said this in the mindfulness talk. I'll probably talk about it tomorrow. You can do things called programming your mindfulness, which means at the beginning of the meditation, you give instructions, say, I will not see anything of the future. I will not see anything of the future. I will not see anything of the future. You put that instruction in at the beginning of the meditation and it actually works. So any problem you have in the meditation, such as, say, getting afraid when a limiter comes up, I will not get afraid when the limiter comes up. I will not get afraid when the limiter comes up. I will not get afraid when the limiter comes up. Repeat it to yourself 3 times, as mindful as you possibly can, and that works. You know, you actually change habits. If it's during your sleep and you have nightmares, you know, you have sort of bad dreams, you say, I will not have a bad dream, I will not have a bad dream, I will not have bad dreams, slowly and carefully, just when you go to sleep tonight. And it's amazing how effective that is. A little self-suggestion, self-hypnosis, and it really does work well. Okay, last question. Is another smiley face. Can you please explain the difference between Ajahn, Pra, Venerable, Reverend, Prakru, etc.? Okay, these are just titles they give to monks. And we like sort of funny titles because sometimes the old titles. Pra is just a Thai word, means venerable. Ajahn just means teacher. Reverend is like the word they use for priests, and so they give it to monks as well. Prakru is a title which Thai monks get. Sometimes it's Chao Kun. So all these are titles, but I said the one I like the best is your emptiness, yes. But it's amazing how fat an emptiness can be. So you can call me your fatness. Is that good? Your fullness. How about your roundness? Your roundness, Ajahn Brahm. There is a sincere question to seek deeper understanding. Okay, last night's unfortunate view that a female body may not achieve awakening. What did the Buddha teach on misogynistic patriarchy energies? He said that's unskillful, that's unwholesome, you don't need to do that. He was very good on that because he made a point when one of the kings got a daughter and was upset. I wanted a son. And he said, no, the daughters can be very powerful. They're wonderful. They can do everything a man can do. So he was actually saying a few times, you know, talking up that sort of an equity between men and women. He managed to make sure that women could also become nuns. Just like the monks become, just like men become monks. I'm getting tired, I better be careful. So the Buddha was into equity and fairness. Didn't really matter who you were. The chanting, for example, during our morning pujas are singings, rising and lowering of tones brought by rising and ebbing of waveforms. What's the big fuss? All the Buddhist traditions have them until they become not okay. There's singing and there's chanting, and the chanting is different from singing. Do you want to start doing hip-hop for the morning chanting? That's as far as I'm going. What is the Buddhist view of your view on numerology, feng shui, horoscope? Please advise. Thanks. One of my friends had trouble with his marriage. He tried everything. I couldn't help him. He got a feng shui master. And the feng shui master said the furniture was wrongly arranged. That's what he said. And so my friend rearranged the furniture. And I asked him, did it work? He said, it worked perfectly. I rearranged the furniture. Now I've got no more problem with my wife. When she was out shopping, I rearranged it all against the door. Now she can't come in. There's no more any problem. That's a feng shui joke. One more question. Really, this is going to be the last question. Dear Ajahn, who came up with the Abhidharma teacher? Now the Abhidharma teachings. Thank you. That was a lot of monks who tried to actually try and explain the Dhamma in a an organized way. It's too late to say methodological. In an organized way. So they started having six of this and eight of that and ten of the others. So this is where the Abhidharma came from. And this is actually what the Buddha said where books came from monks who couldn't meditate. So a lot of times we got into study instead of meditating. So people who meditate, you can write some books, but they're not supposed to be just taken on their face value. They're guidebooks, they're menus, they're things which are encouraging people to practice what's there. They're like menus, they're not the food. But sometimes we mistake the food for the menu, and then we get sort of more menus, and the menus gets more complicated. So remember, when the Buddha taught, he taught ordinary people. You know, people who had hardly any education. You know, from people who were physically deformed. Crazy people like Patachara, murderers like Angulimala, prostitutes like Ambapali. Ordinary people. And they all became enlightened arahats. So you didn't need a university education to become enlightened. But sometimes the Abhidharma is so complicated that only sort of really intelligent people can sort of understand it. And to me that means that this is not real Buddhism. Buddhism was for ordinary people, in teachings which everybody could understand, even simple villagers. And that was a wonderful thing about an Ajahn Chah. These simple villagers who only had 3 or 4 years education at school could understand, and so could all these professors from Bangkok, and all these crazy Westerners who went to Cambridge, they could understand it too. And so it's amazing, his skill. And that would be the same skill of a Buddha. All levels of society, they could understand what's being said. So that is the talk for this evening. There's a few questions which haven't been answered. But it is now 10 o'clock. So it is late. It is a time when monks should go to bed. So we now do the sharing of merits. And after the sharing of merits, we can do the three sadhus. Ida meya tinang ho tu sukita hontu yatayo. Ida meya tinang ho tu sukita hontu yatayo. Ida meya tinang ho tu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Please be careful if you walk home past the cemetery tonight. Bump, bump, bump. Good night, see you tomorrow.